Good morning. It is 8:06 on this Wednesday, August 6th. I'm Christine Weller, filling in for Leslie Thatcher on the local news hour. As far as traffic this morning, we've got the usual slowdowns near Kimball Junction on I-80. And we've got, other than that, pretty clear roads. But, oh, as always, look out for those slowdowns near Kimball Junction. We've got 54 degrees Fahrenheit right now in Park City and 53 degrees over in Heber. With a more in-depth weather update, we've got ABC4 meteorologist Seth Sanders.
Good morning. I'm ABC weather forecaster Seth Sanders. Today's temperatures are going to be warming up a few degrees warmer than they were yesterday, putting us just a couple degrees above seasonal norms. Park City will have a daytime high of 88 degrees. The Heber Valley, a little bit warmer at 93 degrees. Expect periods of patchy smoke and hazy sunshine this morning and through the afternoon as smoke from wildfires in not only Utah, but Arizona and California continue to impact the state. And we do have critical fire conditions. A red flag warning is in effect for the area until Thursday at 9 p.m. Very dry conditions. We're looking at humidity as low as 10%, and it's going to be breezy with gusts up to 35 miles an hour and sustained winds up to 15, even 20 miles an hour coming out of the southwest. The elevated fire threat could hold on even longer. As we get into tomorrow, Thursday is looking like we have more sunshine and periods of patchy smoke. Temperatures similar to where they'll be today. Daytime high in Park City, 88 degrees, and 93 for Heber City, similar to what we see today. More clouds will start to move in by Friday. Partly cloudy skies are expected for Park City, Heber, a mix of sun and clouds. And then temperatures are going to be cooling down quite a bit. A cold front comes through, but it's not going to be bringing any precipitation, just a few clouds and a drop in temperatures by about 10 degrees. 79 degrees will be the daytime high in Park City for your Friday, 86 for Heber City. Temperatures stay cool for the next couple of days after that. Saturday and Sunday, temperatures will still be in the upper 70s to low 80s for Park City and mid to upper 80s for Heber City. As we start next week, things are going to start warming up. Monday, temperatures climb back to the mid 80s and low 90s. And as we get into Tuesday, it's going to continue warming on up, but no precipitation in sight. An elevated fire threat is going to persist. From ABC4, I'm forecaster Seth Sanders.
A Utah judge should take a black and white view of state referendum law and keep a Kimball Junction housing development off the November ballot. That's according to attorneys for Summit County Clerk Eve First. KPCW's Connor Thomas reports.
Earlier this year, Clerk Eve First deemed a citizen referendum on the controversial Kimball Junction development insufficient based on how its signature packets were submitted. First says individual signature pages were separated from the packets, citing pictures of signature gathering events. She says that's not allowed. And her attorney's right, Utah code requires a referendum packet to be bound together as a unit. It supports a black and white analysis. Binding turns a stack of papers into a referendum packet. Removing the binding turns a referendum into a stack of papers. Supporters of the referendum have challenged First in 3rd District Court. They say she's misinterpreted state law and that Judge Richard Mrozek should rule that the signatures she rejected are valid. That would put the Dakota Pacific development to a public vote of county residents on November 4th. Supporters have questioned the quality of First's evidence and say Utah law doesn't discriminate between or mandate a particular type of binding. They argue a prior Utah Supreme Court ruling backs that up. In response, First's attorneys say the petitioner's arguments in court have raised more factual questions than they answered. Mrozek could decide the issue during a hearing August 19th. The petitioners argue that preserving the referendum preserves the ability to file a second legal challenge against the new state law that county officials say makes the referendum moot, Senate Bill 26. First's attorneys say that's not for Mrozek to decide, writing, any hypothetical hope that petitioners might later prevail in a challenge to SB 26 is not enough for this case. The new law was passed in March after the Summit County Council approved the development next to Skullcandy's headquarters in Kimball Junction in December, and residents filed for a referendum on that decision. The law's sponsor says it's intended to greenlight the project, and County Manager Shane Scott complied, approving the project again July 28th. Residents who want a countywide vote on the project have expressed frustration with First in recent months, with some implying she rejected signatures because she's pro-development or on Dakota Pacific's side. At a July interim legislative session hearing, Layton Republican Representative Trevor Lee said of the signature rejection, quote, "It's almost like it's malicious." Through her attorneys, First says that's shooting the messenger. She said some of the petition signatures were invalidated based on state referendum law. Utah legislators may reform that law next year. As Salt Lake Democratic Senator Karen Kwan said in July, we don't want to have laws that seem like gotchas. Summit County is a financial supporter of KPCW. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
On the phone with us, we've got Summit County Community Development Director Peter Barnes. He's got an update on development projects throughout the county. Hi, Peter.
Good morning, Christine. How are you?
Doing well. How are you?
Another fabulous day in paradise.
Indeed. So, as we always start, are there any new development applications?
Well, nothing to get excited about. We're in that time of year where the larger projects have been thrashed out. The next set of larger projects will presumably be on their way later on in the year. So currently we're just ticking over with the standard and routine low impact permits, the odd conditional use permit. We did get one interesting one, nothing for the public generally to get excited about. It happens rarely, twice a year maybe, and that's a special exception request. It's very particular, very unique to a homeowner on a particular site who doesn't actually have a method in the code to achieve what it is they want. So they effectively have a process where they go directly to the county council to ask for exactly what it describes is a special exception to the code. So they're rare. They don't come up very often. We do have an application for one, but it's nothing that would impact anyone but the immediate property owner and their immediate neighbors. So.
Okay, and the county manager has approved the Dakota Pacific project. Has your office seen secondary applications yet regarding the specifics of the development?
No, not yet. What's going to happen as soon as this the document is ratified, signed by all parties, gets recorded? From my perspective, what really needs to happen is that the county will be joined in long conversations with DPRE about the joint venture aspects of the project. We have 180 days to come up with an agreement in that respect to what we call the P3 portion of the project, where the county and DPRE are actually sharing development responsibilities, land investment, etc. So the details of that have to be thrashed out. To the extent that I will be involved, it will only be on a superficial level to make sure that those codes are kept up to date and the plan is being adhered to. From my perspective, the same 180-day period, we actually have to prepare what's known as a housing and transit reinvestment zone plan application that we actually take down to the state. To justify the creation of a zone, it creates a taxing opportunity for the county, like a local taxing entity that allows money that's created by the future a tax increase to be reinvested in the transit side of the project, and also to facilitate the construction of the affordable housing on the project. So those are the two aspects of it. From DPRE's perspective, yes, they will be preparing final site plans, subdivision plans, individual project plans. They will probably be running in conjunction with the preparation of the architectural design guidelines or standards as they're described in the development agreement. They actually have to be submitted and approved before we can take in any project application. They will be reviewed by the Planning Commission and approved by the county manager in the same way the DA was, but it will be drilling down into the details of the actual design requirements of the project. So we're looking forward to that exercise. They're always fun.
Okay, and so that means High Valley Transit has signed on to the agreement, so this is ongoing now.
I'm gonna defer that. I'm gonna assume they have, but that might not be true because they actually have to take it back to their board. They signed on the original approval that the council created. This is essentially the same document. A couple of tweaks, you know, a 5-unit change out of 900, and a slight adjustment to the phasing aspect of the project that the manager actually tweaked last week. So the manager has signed it. DPRE have it in their possession. I don't know if the document has actually been put in front of High Valley Transit's board. I can easily find that out. Caroline Rodriguez will tell us immediately. I have no reason to suppose it won't be signed by them, but you never know.
Okay, let's move on to the Crossroads at Silver Lake project. It's a project proposed by Columbus Pacific Development that requires a rezone. When was the last time the council rezoned such a substantial piece of land? Because this parcel is around 14 acres, is that right?
Yeah. The last rezone we actually did would have been for the Lincoln Station project. This project needs the rezone application. At one point, a couple of years ago, Tony Tyler of Columbus Pacific, he actually came in looking for a rezone to the NMU zone, which would have been the first rezone we had. Since then, he's gone back and reworked the project, and he's coming back with the CC zone. They're all, you know, great initials that mean nothing to most people. It's due to the fact that the project as proposed today is less intense than the previous version, so the NMU zone wouldn't be required, that the height wouldn't be needed, and the flexibility in the NMU zone wasn't. So coming back with a slightly more simple version of it under the CC zone. But we do rezones very rarely, and they do require a lot of work up front. The only other one we actually have on the table as a potential rezone is the reworking of the outlet mall, which is also in process right now and has been going backwards and forwards between staff and applicant and planning commission for over a year now. And they are looking at an NMU rezone simply because of the intensity of use and the heights and flexibility involved in that one. So there are exciting and ongoing projects. Look forward to a few more hearings in front of the Planning Commission before the end of the year, before we take any action. But pay attention. These things are worth looking at, and public input is always welcome.
Do we know for sure when the Snyderville Basin Planning Commission will hear from the developer next?
No. It's imminent, shall we say. The developer, you know, we had one work session in front of the Planning Commission regarding the subdivision and the potential subdivision. Some comments and conversations came out of that. The developer goes back to rework those. As soon as we come back with those details, we'll book our next session, and that will be notified. But currently, no calendar date for that.
All right. And last time the developer asked about a special exception regarding setbacks. Was the Planning Commission amenable to that?
The Planning Commission were. We have to be careful about the terms because I've already used the phrase special exception today. The standard setbacks in pretty much any zone that we have in Summit County, we have 30-foot front yard setbacks, 12-foot side yard setbacks, 12-foot rear yard setbacks, and they're fairly standard on pretty much any project on any lot. If you think about a standard 12-foot side yard setback, well, that sounds perfectly reasonable on a large lot, but suppose I'm building townhomes. Obviously, I have a zero setback to a townhome on a side yard. So what actually happens is that the zone requirement, and for example, the same in the CC zone, the requirement is actually, unless otherwise shown on approved plat, the setback shall be, and there is a default. So the question that the developer was asking up front is the Planning Commission amenable to approving a subdivision modification, which is going to be part of the process, that in itself describes a different setback than the one required by the code? And the Planning Commission, based on the site plan that they saw, didn't really have any objection to it. They thought what was being described and proposed was a good idea. Now, obviously, as a description by the developer, it sounds like a good idea. We just need to be very careful on our end that we've actually investigated all the potential consequences and made sure that the advantages that are being created outweigh any potential disadvantages that might come from the reduced setback. So there is a little bit of analysis there, but there was no fear and angst created at the Planning Commission level. We just need to make sure the technical requirements are being resolved.
Okay, so why exactly does Summit County have setback minimums?
Everybody does. In reality, if you think about Old Town Park City, for example, the residential setback on those 25-foot wide lots is 3 feet. Setbacks are usually there for privacy concerns, sometimes they're for fire concerns. The building code doesn't really require it. It just means it's a different type of building construction. But imagine a house that's built 2 feet from the road. you pull off the road into your garage and you're parked on your driveway waiting for your garage door to open with the back end of your car sticking out into the road. Clearly that's a mistake. So if you, you know, if you move the house further away from the road, then the car can pull off the street onto its own driveway, then either park or maneuver into its own private parking location. So clearly there are obvious advantages for minimum setbacks. If you have two houses back to back, you know, do you want bedroom windows 10 feet from each other looking into each other's bedroom, or do you want them 20 or 30 feet? So a lot of it can be privacy. Some of it could be snow shed, could be from the practical application of how do I maintain a building if I, you know, if I've built a zero side yard setback, how do I walk around the side of my building to touch up the paintwork when I, in order to do so, I have to encroach on my neighbor's property? So there's all sorts of reasons, and they're there for different reasons. Sometimes a uniform minimum is a little bit odd and needs to be adjusted. Sometimes they need to be bigger, sometimes they need to be smaller, and that's where the individual project designs come into play.
Okay, that makes sense. I also wanted to ask, what is happening with Klein Dolly? The developer got the bid from Summit County to build housing and other things there, but hasn't met to negotiate in a while. So what's happening with that?
We're actually in ongoing conversations. A small group of us, two councillors, staff, and the developer have been having weekly meetings since the negotiation was announced to discuss. At this point, we're actually still discussing, you know, the, you know, potential tweaks and challenges from the financing aspect of the project that we need to go through. I'm personally looking forward to delving into the details of the design. That's my forte and strength. Currently, a lot of these conversations go over my head, but we have many experts sitting around the table talking about how different forms of the investment work, how the phasing might work, how the financing projects this complicated, involving this many financing solutions and options, take a great deal of effort to actually understand how they're going to work. So since they announced the awarding of that negotiation to Columbus Pacific, we've been having conversations of that type. Nothing specific to report, no drama out there. It's just an ongoing back and forth about potential options.
Okay. Can you recap at all what will go on that area, on that property?
Well, the project as presented by the developer team actually included a new fire station for the Park City Fire District, a potential rec center and aquatic center from Basin Rec. They would be part of the partnership. And then a housing project. I think it's 176 units, 167 units. And of various types of different ownership and affordability levels. But the developer, as well as having their own portion of the project, we're also partnering with Mountain Lands Community Housing Trust and Habitat for Humanity as part of the project. So there will be a mixed housing type, some, you know, small apartments, detached single family with accessory apartments in them, all created and owned by separate entities as part of the project. So a lot of moving parts, a lot of people involved. The council thought the mix of the team was really creative and ambitious, but, you know, trying to tame all those people at the same time and bring all those mutual interests together is complicated, obviously.
Yeah, that makes sense. Is there anything else you think our listeners should know?
Not at the moment. We're actually in a little bit of a lull from my end. Obviously, the big construction project is the Canyons Parking Garage. The bulk of the trucks you'll see driving through Snyderville Basin coming from any large construction project will be the construction work over at the Canyons. Apart from that, no drama from my end. We're entering into budget season, but at the moment, everyone is more excited about the Summit County Fair. So that's what we're looking forward to.
All right. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much. Bye now.
We've been speaking with Summit County Community Development Director Peter Barnes. Joining us on the phone is Chabad of Park City Director Yudi Steiger to talk about Utah's first ever Jewish festival in Park City. Welcome.
Thank you.
So I first just wanted to talk about how this festival was born. It's the first ever Jewish festival in Utah. How did this come about?
We've hosted many events in Park City, for Chabad of Park City, over the last 13 years or so since we opened up Chabad in Park City. And we had speakers and singers, and they were usually in a venue indoors. And then we're like a year ago, we had someone come up to us in the community. And this is something that I've always kind of dreamt of, you really to be able to display our Jewishness openly and invite the entire community, not just have it in a closed space, but really celebrate our heritage and our traditions in front of the community and invite everyone to join. And finally, we're able to make it happen.
Can you talk a little bit about what into making this festival a reality? How long has this been in the works?
The idea when we kind of decided to make it happen, I would say, was last year in July. Mainly because of what happened to the to October 7th and the attack on the Jewish people in Israel. And it's something that we decided it's important to actually make it happen. And we approached the Canyons Village, I would say probably in December. And that's when it started, December of 2024. We met up at the Canyons, and we started working on it since then. And it's been a lot of work making it happen. And finally, it's here.
Great. What can people expect at the festival today? What are some highlights?
The big highlights are our performers that are coming in, which is Eighth Day, which they're a Disney featured artist. They've really done great music, and all the music has great messages for everyone. And they're just great performers. And of course, Zusha, which is a lot of people have been looking forward to. They have the really, I would say, the ability to connect different cultures and being able to show the beauty of Judaism. There's a lot of, I think, misunderstanding out there. And I think Zusha has the ability to be able to build bridges. They've performed at the Electric Forest in Michigan, I think it was last month. And a lot of people have been looking forward to them, to their music. A lot of people, Jewish and non-Jewish, are listening to their music and really enjoy their music. So I think that's one of the big highlights. There will be a food truck and some other Jewish cultural activities at the festival. And I think the most important big highlight is just simply bring a smile, come open, and be excited and have fun. Have a good time.
Right. And you're encouraging Jewish people as well as non-Jewish people to attend. Is that right?
Correct. Absolutely. It's. I think there is a lot of a misunderstanding about the Jewish community. And I think that's what we want to do. That's why the event is also free for people to join. We want people to come and see what the culture is about, see what Judaism is about. And there's just a lot of love, and that's a beautiful community, and we just want people to learn more about the community. And for the Jewish people, we want them to also be proud of who they are. We've heard people having concerns about the anti-Semitism the rampant anti-Semitism, and some people in the community don't feel safe to be able to join. And so it's importantly, especially at this time, not to give in into anti-Semitism. Because if you ask the anti-Semite, should I join, should I not join, they tell you absolutely not. We don't want the Jewish people to have a good time, to get together, to be able to openly celebrate their faith, to celebrate their culture, and so to the Jewish community also, it's like, don't give in to the anti-Semites and be proud of who you are. Come celebrate. We have lots of security also at the event to make sure that we can be as safe as possible.
Okay. Does that mean you're partnering with local law enforcement for the event?
Correct. With local law enforcement, as well as we're hiring a private security firm.
Okay. Can you tell us some details? What time does the event start and how long does it run?
The event is at 6 p.m. at the Canyons Village, base of the Canyons Village. And it should be about 2.5 hours. So from about 6 to about 8:30 p.m.
Wonderful. Are you planning on having another festival perhaps next year, or are you kind of waiting to see how this one goes?
No, absolutely. We've already, the response in the community, Jewish or non-Jewish, has been just overwhelming. When we started planning this, we never thought that we would get to the to where we are today. We have well over 600 people that already reserved seats at the event, and so it's just it's only going to get bigger and better. And absolutely, this is the first of many.
Great. Do you know, is it mostly people within the Park City area, or are people traveling from across the state? Do you know anything about that?
So we've actually heard of people traveling from St. George. Some people, even when they heard about the festival, they were contemplating where to go on vacation. And when they heard we have this festival, they decided from New York, they decided to come to Park City all the way from New York also. So it's bringing people, even from Colorado also, it has been bringing people together, but it's certainly mostly from Park City.
Okay. I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit more about, you've mentioned that there are some misunderstandings about the Jewish community. What do you think people should know about the Jewish community?
I mean, the misunderstanding is unfortunately people are being fed things that are not so true about the Jewish people. So, but I think, you know, it's about the Jewish people. We no harm against anyone. It's a beautiful community, and we have beautiful celebrations, whether it's holiday, whether it's just social events. And there's people that really have nothing. Don't even have an ounce of hatred or towards anyone. All we want is just to be part of the community like everyone else. And I think the best way to fight the misconceptions that are going around is by inviting another friend, a non-Jewish friend, to a Shabbat dinner. Show them how beautiful it is. Invite them to a Passover Seder and see the beautiful Jewish traditions that we have and how we celebrate. And I think that's just simply the best way. Once you actually meet most people that have hatred toward the Jewish people are people that don't know anything about the Jewish faith or about the Jewish people. And it's just baseless. And so come learn about the Jewish people. You know, today is an opportunity for, even if you don't know anyone in the Jewish community, to just come and be part of it. Just come, see, watch, and if you want, talk to another person, talk to another Jewish person in the community, talk about their faith, just let's have a dialogue. And I think that's the best way to be able to fight what's the unfortunate anti-Semitism that we see around us.
I think that was well said. Is there anything else you think our listeners should know?
Come curious, come open-minded, and just join us, and you'll be have a great time, and that's it.
All right.
We're excited to have you there.
All right.
ParkCityJewishFestival.com is where people could go.
Perfect. And you do want people to make a reservation, even though it's free. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. It just takes a minute. It's for security reasons. It's just easier and better if people could just do it online. Yes, correct.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Yudi.
Thank you. Have a great day.
We've been speaking with Chabad of Park City Director Yudi Steiger on Utah's first ever Jewish festival in Park City. Nearly 70% of Wasatch County drivers say they've narrowly avoided crashes on North US 40. KPCW's Grace Dorfler has more about a safety survey from the Utah Department of Transportation.
UDOT asked Wasatch County drivers to share their experiences on US 40 to help decide whether to install concrete barriers along the highway from River Road to 1200 North. The proposed barriers are in response to a spate of bad crashes on that stretch. Since January 2017, UDOT reports there have been 49 opposite direction crashes on those 3 miles of road, including 8 fatalities and 22 serious injuries. But UDOT is also interested in preventing other dangerous situations on US 40. In a survey last month, over 400 people shared what it's like to drive on the road. Nearly 50% of respondents said they rarely or never feel safe driving there. Just under 70% said they've experienced near misses on the highway, including dangerous left turns and vehicles crossing the center line. Half of those surveyed said they avoid going to destinations in that section of 40. Drivers overwhelmingly support UDOT's proposed barriers, with 86% saying longer travel times are worth it if it means fewer serious and deadly crashes. If UDOT moves forward with the barriers, it will also add several traffic lights, so left turns are only allowed at certain intersections. One traffic light will be installed by the end of summer for access to the Coyote Ridge neighborhood, according to UDOT regional spokesperson Wyatt Woolley. Design of the rest of the project will happen this fall. To see all the survey results, visit kpcw.org. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
In the studio with us, we've got Park City Opera Artistic Director Ben Beckham and baritone Jake Stamatis. They have details on the nonprofit's first main stage production, The Barber of Seville.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yes, thank you.
Thanks for joining us. Ben, I'm wondering if you can first just start by talking a little bit about how we've gotten opera back in Park City after 20 years.
Definitely. So we established Park City Opera in 2024. My co-founders, Liesl Vangerman and Lena Goldstein, and I all were really excited about bringing more arts to Park City. Lena, our executive director, had worked for the Summit County Arts Council and saw that there's so much culture here in Park City, but classical music and specifically classical vocal music and opera was definitely a deficit in the cultural scene. So we were really excited about making something happening. Last summer, we called our preview season. We had about 20 different concerts, events, pop-ups, where we wanted to ask the question, does opera have a home here in Park City? Could we find an audience? Are there people that are interested in this? And that answer was a resounding yes. We were absolutely blown away by the community's support. And we decided to go through with our first full season this summer, including the very first main stage opera for Park City Opera and the first opera occurring in Park City in about 20 years, our production of The Barber of Seville coming up at the end of the month.
Okay, I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit more about the basic storyline of this opera.
Definitely. So The Barber of Seville is by Rossini. It's a hilarious comedy. It was written in the mid-1800s, and despite being almost 200 years old, it is still hilarious. Jake, do you want to tell us a little bit about the story?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I love this opera, and it's one that comes up a lot in the opera community because it is so beloved and is so popular. The story has some complications in it, but the bare bones of it is a love story. This man, the Count Almaviva, sees a woman from her window and falls in love with her at sight. And so his mission then becomes, how do I meet this girl? So he enlists the ever willing, ever capable Figaro, who's sort of the guy you go to if you've got a problem, and he asks Figaro, hey, you got to help me meet this girl. And so then Figaro starts going to work, putting together plans so that he can get them to meet together. The issue is that Rosina, who is the girl, is sort of in a state of being trapped. She is staying in the home with this man who is her, and she is his ward, so she has sort of an obligation to him, and he is in love with her and wants to marry her, but she's not interested. So it becomes like a rescue mission in the end. And on the way, it's full of jokes and farce, disguises, and everything you can imagine. And so it really is a jam-packed evening of opera, comedy, laughs, and a really good time.
Right, and you'll be playing Figaro, is that right?
Yes, that is correct. I'll be singing the role of Figaro. This will be my third time performing this role. It is one of my absolute favorites, and so I'm really excited to revisit it here in Park City.
Awesome. I'm wondering if you can also talk a little bit about how you became an opera singer. How did you get into this art?
Yes. So I am originally from a small town in Pennsylvania called Tunkhannock. You've probably never heard of it.
I have not.
Most people have not. It is a tiny little rural town.
There might be one KPCW
there
listener.
Might be one.
And,
and I'm talking right to you, my friend. It's just outside of Scranton. And something about Tunkhannock is that it's a beautiful place to live, but there isn't necessarily a large classical music scene. And so I hadn't even heard opera until I got to college. I really loved singing choir in school, so I decided, oh, I'm going to go to college to become a choir director to teach in the public schools. And it was there in college at Susquehanna University in Pennsylvania that I first heard opera for the first time, and I first did my first opera. And it was by doing it and hearing it, I realized, oh my gosh, what is this? This thing I'd never heard before, I've never experienced before. The drama, the vocal Olympics that it takes to just sing any of these operas is just so impressive to me, and the challenge of it, it's almost like a puzzle. And I loved the foreign language element of that. I should say that The Barber of Seville is an opera in Italian. Not to worry, if you come to see it, we will have the translation projected there. So it's almost like watching a foreign film. You've got the subtitles there telling you what's going on. So not at all an issue if you're not an Italian speaker. But it was the languages, the sort of international appeal of it that really drew me to opera. So I switched gears, went full bore to being an opera singer, and I have not looked back since.
Wow. I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit more, because like you said, these operas are often in foreign languages.
Mm-hmm.
What does it take to prepare for these roles?
Oh, yes. It takes a lot, I will say. I remember speaking to some family members, for instance, when I first started doing opera, and they thought, oh, you guys just get together and just put it on, right? And I'm like, oh, no. There's an incredible amount of preparation that comes beforehand. So let's start with the language. Studying the language is very important. I would not say that I am as fluent as I would like to be in all these languages yet, but I'm working on it. It is a lifelong process.
You could not tell from Jake's Italian in the rehearsal. It is incredible, the whole cast.
And that is the key. Even if we don't have spoken fluency in the language, our goal is to sound as authentic as possible. So what this means is I do a lot of good homework. So translating these operas so I know exactly what I'm saying. And with that, then I can tell the story. You know, we're doing a play up there, and I'm playing a character, so it's very important to tell the story with authenticity and in a way that's understandable to the audience, even if they don't understand the language. So really mastering the language, not only knowing what I'm saying, but making sure my pronunciation is as perfect as possible. So there's the language. Then there comes the music. A sort of hallmark of opera singing is that it extends the entire vocal range of the person singing it. So we've got the high notes, we've got the low notes, we've got everything in between, slow notes, fast notes, all of that. And all of it requires really specific technique. You know, we're doing something very virtuosic. It's almost like the Olympics of singing. And on top of doing all these complicated singing passages, we have to do it without microphones. Everything is unamplified. So what I really like about this, and what I really am, you know, excited by when it comes to doing opera, is we're showing the audience what is possible from the human voice. What can the human voice do just on its own, as far as being loud, being soft? Can you hear me, you know, on the other end of a football field? You know, that's what we're trying to master in our singing. So we've got the language, we've got the virtuosic singing, then comes the acting. So preparing, making sure that we can tell the story to an audience very clearly using our motions on stage, the gestures we make with our hands, our facial expressions. You know, I can just stand up there in a tuxedo and just sing pretty, or I can really get into the character. How does he move? What, you know, makes him laugh? You know, how does he interact with the other characters? What's their relationship? So adding that acting element to it really completes the picture. So that's what I'm thinking about when preparing to do an opera performance.
Go ahead.
If I might jump in here, when you see an opera singer at the peak of their game, and including Jake and many singers from the rest of our cast, despite the fact that the opera might be in Italian, might be in French, might be in German or another language, when they bring all of these things together, what's happening on stage is just so incredibly understandable. The amount of communication that is able to cross the linguistic barrier to the audience is just beyond belief. And I don't think it's something that happens not only in any other art form, but really anywhere else in the world.
Yeah, and I love how you've been calling this the Olympics of, you know, singing about, yeah. You know, It's amazing, and I'm wondering, obviously this takes a lot of time to master. How long have you been preparing for this performance specifically?
Well, I've just arrived in Park City. I've been here for maybe 3 days now, which is great. We're just getting started, and we still have about 3 weeks until the performance is ready to go up. So that's great. We're going to have time for that. We've been working on the music now because, as I'm sure you could imagine from what I was saying, a lot of the work happens in private. You know, it's a lot of solo work on my part to make sure that I'm on top of my game and I know all of my music very well and that I understand my language and my character, all that personal work. And that can take a month. It could take, you know, a year. It could take, you know, if I'm really rushed, I could cram it into a weekend, you know, but that's not ideal. Oh my gosh. But, you know, it really can take a lot of time when you want to prepare very well. And so that's the private part of it. But then we arrive, and then there's the whole extra element of putting it together with the other people. Because if I prepare on my own for a show, I've just been doing my part, but then we get to the point where it's like, okay, well, how does this fit in with the other characters? You know, what are their ideas? They're coming with their ideas. And then on top of that, we've got the stage director who's leading us through the acting and everything, making sure everyone's going in the same direction and doing the same show. So we're adding that in. And then we've got, of course, the music director who's conducting. In this case, we are very lucky to have Ben conducting us in this show, who's wonderful, but he's got his own ideas to add to what I'm bringing to the table. So what's kind of cool about doing opera is it's additive. There's not necessarily one person who is deciding it all. Like, it's a big team effort. So I've brought my part, but now we go into this three-and-a-half, four-week process where our work now is to put it together and make a complete, a complete performance. So that's sort of the timeline.
Great. And Ben, I'm also wondering if you can talk a little bit about finding all of these opera singers, because all of them seem to be from different places. So
yes. So we held a national call for auditions back in January. We heard over 100 singers who applied to be a part of Park City Opera's production. We were really honored to have a number of singers who traveled to sing for us live in Park City. And then we also heard a number of singers virtually as well. And when you have that many incredibly talented people to pick from, you come up with just the best of the best. So our whole cast is just spectacular from top to bottom. We have brought 5 singers into Park City to sing leading roles from across the country, and including one singer, Joseph Park, who comes all the way from South Korea. And then in addition to that, we have a handful of local singers who live in the Salt Lake area and here in Park City singing some of the smaller roles and joining the ensemble for the show. And then in addition to that, we have a whole orchestra
of musicians who hail from around Utah who are coming to Park City to be brought together for this production. I just want to say that I'm especially thrilled to have Jake here. Jake and I have a little bit of a backstory. We worked together. Okay. We worked together in Sarasota, Florida at Sarasota Opera a couple of years ago. And so when it came time to produce this production, I was thinking about Jake for the role of Figaro. How great would it be if we could get Jake to Park City to sing in our inaugural main stage, and the stars aligned and it all worked out. And it's just really special to have him here.
That's lovely. We haven't talked about any of the details yet. Can you share when will these performances be on? How much do tickets cost? Give us some of the logistics.
Of course. So we open the show on August 24th at 2 o'clock p.m. It's a Sunday matinee at the Park City Library in the Santee Auditorium. Regular KPCW listeners probably know the Santee from Park City Film. The library is such a gracious host to us. It's going to be a riot of a performance. It's very family friendly. We have intermission activities for kids, educational pre-concert talk. There will be a cotton candy spinner who will be making barber's beards at intermission. So just really fun, a great way to spend an afternoon with the family. Tickets start at $25 for students and kids and seniors, and then $55 for general admission. And then the next weekend, in true Park City Opera fashion, because Park City does not have an opera house, so we move around quite a bit in PC, we take the opera just right up Main Street to Premier Park City, which is a speakeasy right at the top of Main Street. You might know that space by its old name, O.P. Rockwell. But it's a speakeasy and music lounge that has a stage that seats about 160 people. Of course, being a bar, it is 21 plus for those performances, which are August 29th and 30th, a Friday and Saturday, both at 7 o'clock p.m. But the real appeal of the premiere is, first of all, I don't think anyone listening has ever seen an opera in a speakeasy. This is your chance. And beyond that, the premiere is a great restaurant. There will be themed cocktails, themed food pairings, a real fun date night out on August 29th and 30th at the premiere.
This sounds like quite the production and like a lot of fun stuff. I'm wondering, is there anything coming up in the future for Park City Opera?
Definitely. So actually, there's a couple of chances for KPCW listeners to meet and get to know some of the Park City Opera cast of The Barber of Seville before Barber. So we have a couple of events coming up. First, on August 9th, if you want to make the beautiful drive up to Alta at 6:30 p.m., we're presenting a little concert called Voices on the Mountain at Our Lady of the Snows Center in partnership with Alta Community Enrichment. It is one of the most beautiful venues I've ever performed in, with huge windows that open up to Snowbird right behind the church. Incredible spot. Tickets are $10. You can find everything on parkcityopera.org. On August 11th at 6:30, we are back with Mountain Town Music right here in City Park, presenting Park City Opera in Park City, in Park City Park. Lots of parks and cities in that event title. And that's a free concert that's amplified out on the lawn behind the bandstand. I think Lush's barbecue truck might be in attendance. That's a really fun way to spend an evening. Some KPCW listeners might know Park City Opera from some of our events on the library patio. Just a really nice outdoor summer concert, very much in the spirit of what people love here in Park City. And then on August 13th, I actually will be giving a lecture at the Park City Museum Education Center on the history of opera in Utah. So people might think of opera as being a European art form, as being a coastal kind of East Coast thing. Not at all. Opera has a really long history in Utah that goes all the way back to the Mormon pioneers. It's something that not a lot of people know about, but I think what might be really interesting for people trying to get a little bit more context for what we're doing here in Park City. And then post Barber of Seville, again on August 24th, August 29th and 30th, we are really excited for some fun events in October and then a winter opera in December or January that's going to be announced very soon.
Awesome. Lots of events coming up, lots of fun stuff. Is there anything else you think our listeners should know, either about Park City Opera or about the show coming up?
Definitely. To anyone who's listening who has never seen an opera before,
The Barber of Seville is the perfect first opera and just an incredible time. It's, I said this before on the interview, it is just a comedic masterpiece. It's hilarious. We had, on our first day of rehearsal, we do something called a libretto read. The libretto is the text for the opera. Let me tell you, I would have paid tickets to have just watched that. We had so much fun. We were all dying of laughter. Now we get to put 3 weeks of work into it to make it, you know, a beautiful production. So it's going to be a really special event. I really highly encourage anyone who wants to come out to come see it.
Great. Thank you both so much for joining us. We've been speaking with Park City Opera Artistic Director Ben Beckham and baritone Jake Stamatis. Thank you guys so much.
Thanks so much for having us.